Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome to another episode on the New Books Network. I'm one of your hosts, Dr. Miranda Melcher, and I'm very excited to have with me today Dr. Kevin Blackburn to tell us all about his book titled The Comfort Women of Singapore in History and Memory, published by the National University of Singapore Press in 2022. This book takes a subject that in some senses is quite well known, the euphemism term comfort women of the Japanese military using women for sex work during the Second World War throughout the territory that the Japanese military conquered and occupied. And this is a subject that is particularly well known, for example, in the context of Korean women, both in Korea and throughout that wider territory, and has become something of a political movement and certainly a political issue between South Korea and Japan today, starting in the 1990s. What this book looks at, however, is this institution, I suppose, in Singapore, and asks a whole bunch of questions about why we don't see the same sort of memory and people coming forward in Singapore, despite the kind of clear historical facts that this happened in Singapore too. So this is a really important, I think, historical contribution to understand kind of what actually happened in Singapore and how it's been remembered since and why. So Kevin, I'm very pleased to welcome you to the show to tell us about your book.
Good. Thank you, Miranda. I'm an historian and I work at the National Institute of Education, which is part of Nanyang Technological University in Singapore. I decided to write this book because there was a real danger that these women would literally disappear from history. I was inspired by actually a novelist, Jingjing Li, actually, and she wrote a work of fiction called How We Disappeared. And it was about the comfort women of Singapore and how they had disappeared into history. And I noticed that basically the book was published in 2019, that this was probably an indication of what was happening in reality, actually. It was an excellent novel, but it was a work of fiction. So I decided that, you know, I would prove that these women did exist, because there's been many kind of doubts about the existence of these women, because they never did come forward to give their stories in the 1990s when the comfort women issue became an international controversy. And there was never any kind of explanation about why they didn't come forward. So I essentially wanted to tackle those two questions. One was, why they didn't come forward, and also their existence, because essentially they've taken their stories to their graves, really. Even the youngest ones, in their teens, now would be in their mid-90s, actually. So effectively, these women have kept a silence, and they've taken, the silence to their graves. Very few of them, if none of them, I would imagine, would still be alive.
Mm. Thank you for raising kind of the two key questions of the book and explaining a little bit sort of what the stakes are really in investigating them. But before we kind of get into some of the answers to those questions, obviously you've just kind of alluded to one of the challenges of researching this topic, right? That people are not coming forward and that it's now essentially out of living memory. But there's a lot of other sort of challenges around methodology, definitions, ethics for researching these two questions that you've raised. So before we get into your answers, could you tell us a bit about how you navigated those challenges?
Yes, doing the research is a challenge in itself, but also, you know, ethical considerations are a challenge too. We can look at these, you know, quite clearly, actually, in terms of, you know, just terminology. In a way, comfort women, comfort stations are just euphemisms used by the Japanese military to describe, you know, sex slaves, which the women were, and also to describe the places where they worked, which were places of sexual enslavement. So, you know, one starts off with, you know, these euphemisms that, you know, represent a horrible reality. And one has to kind of make sure that, you know, these euphemisms are understood as such. So at the beginning of the book, I explained this, and there is a convention of putting in inverted commas around comfort women and around comfort stations, and I do that for the book out of you know, respect for the suffering of these women, because, you know, the Japanese military called them comfort women and called their places of enslavement comfort stations, but they were anything but that. And with methodology, another difficult issue too. One relies a lot on oral history testimony of, you know, many women who knew other women who were comfort women. It's very hard to get close to women who were comfort women, because usually they've decided already that they're going to keep this issue private. So when, you know, journalists or researchers are lucky to actually hear that comfort woman exists, usually, you know, one has to kind of obey the instructions of, you know, one's ethics, which is basically that, you know, if these women don't want their stories or don't want to be interviewed, and that's often the case because there's a stigma around any kind of sex work, really, one has to basically, you know, keep, you know, to those considerations. In terms of methodology, yeah, with oral history, yeah, it is an area where it's often criticized because memory is reconstructed in a sense. When one recalls something, one is kind of reconstructing it. So there's not a lot of, you know, kind of consistency that one finds that we see in archival evidence, you know. So usually you have to corroborate your oral history sources, you know, quite meticulously, preferably with archival sources, because there are always individuals who want to deny the existence of comfort women in certain areas or whatever. Usually the people who want to do this, the people who are perhaps called the right-wing nationalists in Japan, they tend to see the comfort women as little more than paid prostitutes. And the lives of these women usually aren't documented in archival evidence. Archival evidence gives us a good idea about how the system was set up, but it doesn't really tell us much about the lives of these women. So one really has to go to oral history to find out the lives of these women and how they tell the story of their lives. In the case of Singapore, it's the Korean women, it's the Indonesian women who actually have told other people, journalists, researchers, about what it was like to be a comfort woman in Singapore. As I said, the testimony doesn't come from the local women, but we know from other oral history testimony that, you know, there were these women that were abducted and taken into comfort stations. There were other women who were working already in the sex industry who were tricked or coerced into the comfort stations as well. So we rely a lot upon evidence to prove that they exist, that is both oral history and archival. So it is well corroborated, because it is one of those issues that generate a great deal of controversy. And as I said before, if you look at, you know, many perceptions of, you know, what happened, that one could, you know, easily come to the wrong conclusion that these women never really existed because they never came forward when in the 1990s, many comfort women in other Asian societies came forward. So, you know, it has been quite a difficult book to write from the perspective of methodological, definitional, and ethical considerations. Thanks.
Well, I'm glad you've explained those kind of overlapping challenges and also some of the ways that you work to nevertheless find this corroborating evidence. So that kind of allows us to go nicely into some of the answers that you come up with in the book, building on some of the information you've just given us. Who were the Singaporean comfort women? How, to what extent were their backgrounds similar to comfort women of other nationalities, like the Korean women you spoke of? Kind of who were these women that haven't come forward?
I'll give the context first, like I do in the book. Singapore was essentially regarded by the members of the Japanese military as a virtual sexual paradise for them, actually. There were so many women of different ethnic and nationalities, such as, you know, there are women from Taiwan, there are women from Indonesia, there are women from China, there were women, you know, from Malaysia as well. And then amongst the local women, there were women who were Eurasian, there were women who were Indian, there were women who were Chinese, and there were women who were Malay, as well as some captured European women who were part of the Japanese military sex industry. So if one looks at this context, one sees that there's a lot of women who are not from Singapore, not locals. So what has happened is that, you know, yes, you do have the testimony from the women. Much of the testimony comes from, you know, basically the Korean women. I think I forgot to mention the Korean women also here, of course. They were the largest number. So a lot of testimony comes from the Korean women about their experiences. And, you know, one can look at that, and then one can look at other sources that one has about, you know, what the local population saw in terms of the local women's experiences. And, in many cases, they work side by side. You know, you had Indonesian women working, you know, next to the women from China and the women from Korea, Japanese women as well, actually. So, you know, by looking at the different testimony from women from various nationalities, one gets a fairly good idea about what life was like in the comfort stations in terms of sexual slavery, in terms of basically how they were treated. There is some variety, of course, in terms of the way they were managed by the comfort station managers or whatever, who could vary. Some could be better than others, but the system itself was so kind of, oppressive that women often, you know, had little agency and were in a difficult situation. It was not uncommon to, you know, particularly on holidays, for these women to actually, you know, serve up to 30 to 50 men in one of the comfort stations. And then, of course, we had women who were, you know, basically contracting sexual diseases from, you know, this, you know, kind of situation they were in. And then actually you had pregnancies as well the women, you know, basically contracted from the industry. So, yeah, they lived in a kind of state of almost like captivity in a sense, actually. Where they could go was limited. Some, of course, had more agency than others. But by and large, the conditions of many of these women was similar to, you know, say Korean women who were in Burma, or, you know, Indonesian women who were also in Singapore, but also, you know, in Indonesia and other parts of the empire. So surprisingly, some of the women when they give their testimony, like there's a Japanese woman who, you know, who talks of, you know, her time in Malaysia and Singapore, and particularly Malaysia, in Kota Kinabalu, actually. So she describes how, you know, they were kind of sisters in a way, because when she fell ill from some sexual disease, she was looked after by one of the local women. You know, so this is in Malaysia. But in Singapore, you do have those type of circumstances as well, where there's some solidarity amongst the women, you know, particularly the ones from the same nationalities, of course. But many Singapore women were sent overseas to Java, to Malaysia. So, yeah, from this, you know, we know generally that they did work, you know, with other women. But still, they, you know, because they knew each other, because, yeah, in some respects, they took, you know, a fairly large number of people from the same place. Like, you know, they had some Cantonese sing-song girls or prostitutes that they sent to Taiping from Chinatown, Singapore, and they were quite cohesive as a group, actually, when they were working in Taiping. Their testimony is actually given by someone who was a visitor, you know, just dropping off goods from the town, a Chinese man, actually, who could obviously speak Cantonese. So they describe the relentless, you know, kind of nature of the sex industry that they were put into. And it was very different from what they experienced in Singapore when they were part of the sex industry. You know, things like that. They described that they had basically no rest at all. The Japanese men there believed that, you know, the menstruation period was, you know, was the time when the female, you know, sex drive was abnormally high. So usually they would stop during this period when they were menstruating. But for the Japanese men, they just continued on. So their conditions were far from ideal, and they did have little autonomy. But, you know, from some stories, they do kind of illustrate, you know, that there were times when, if opportunities arose, they could, you know, have, you know, or greater autonomy.
And what were the backgrounds of these women? Where were they kind of coming from before they were coerced or kidnapped into this sex slavery? Kind of where you mentioned earlier the ages of them, now mid-90s, so that would imply they were really quite young when this happened. What can we know about the backgrounds of these Singaporean women?
Yes, it's interesting, actually. If you look at the fiction, the image that comes out of you know, the novel How We Disappeared, the author focuses on basically one group of women who were coerced, and that is the teenage virgins from the rural areas of Singapore. Basically, the Japanese would you know, come into a village, and they would just abduct young women and bring them into the sex industry. You know, sometimes they just simply raped them, and for a short while, they would basically just, you know, kidnap them, and then they would, you know, be gone, you know, let free after a week. But others, you know, certainly went to comfort stations. So you have the abducted, you know, teenage virgins, but also in the Chinatown area, in the brothel areas, they used, you know, coercion as well. With the existing women who were part of the sex industry, mainly Cantonese prostitutes who were dominant in this kind of trade, actually. So these women, they don't get as much sympathy as the teenage virgins, but the Japanese did, you know, use, the Japanese military did use this similar tactics, but more kind of trickery, using, promising you know, kind of a better life or whatever. But most of them knew that that wasn't going to be the case, so that basically there were elements of coercion even for the women who did work in the sex industry. I kind of document this with the life of one woman who was quite a strong woman, Ho Kwai Min, actually. She was already what's called a high-class prostitute in Chinatown, and she skillfully evaded, you know, several attempts by the Japanese military to actually coerce her into the comfort women system. She preferred to stay very much in the Chinatown, in the existing sex industry that she'd been working in already. It's interesting looking at the variety of experiences, but in many ways they're similar to elsewhere, where you do have, you know, young women being abducted, you have young women who are being tricked, and you do have women from the prostitution and sex industry who are, you know, coerced. And so one finds this not just in Singapore, but also in other countries. So that's, you know, how it went.
And obviously, if we're trying to understand why women chose not to come forward, understanding what happened to them during the war is a key part of that story, but also what happened to them afterwards. So what did happen to the comfort women in Singapore, both those of Singaporean nationality and those from other places that had been brought by the Japanese? What happened to them immediately after the war?
Yes, it's interesting, actually. In a way, Singapore is very similar to what happened with women from Korea, women from other places like Indonesia, too. At the end of the war, they feared going back home because they had been involved in, you know, the sex industry. Of course, you know, it hadn't been their choice or whatever, but nonetheless, because they had, you know, been involved in this, there was a certain stigma, you know, and shame that they felt quite strongly. The Indonesian women were interviewed after the war because there was a search for them by the new Indonesian government, and that became quite public. And, you know, that they gave their testimony, you know, to journalists and people looking for them, and they said that, you know, you know, we've become bad. You know, they use the patriarchal language. You know, it's not our fault because the Japanese did it. And they say that, you know, there's no way they could ever go home to their families in Indonesia, in Java. So this is similar to what happens with the Korean woman too, actually. Already in Singapore, the people of Singapore, the local population, are rather unsympathetic, actually, to the women who are from Korea, and they just simply see them as you know, Japanese prostitutes. So they don't have any sympathy for them. And then, you know, when the Korean women go home, they also, you know, have, you know, the stigma to face if they admit what they're doing. And that's been fairly well documented. And, you know, the Korean women, you know, kept silent for a long time, Japanese women too, actually. So in the case of local women in Singapore, it's very difficult for them, actually, because you know, Singapore is quite a small place, and many people in the villages would know what happened to these women who were coerced by the Japanese into the comfort women system. So what happens is that these women tend to stay in prostitution, many street walking or whatever. Many of them are quite young, so they're under 18. And the government is able to actually, you know, round them up and put them into a home for girls, actually rehabilitating underage prostitutes. So the older ones, you know, they can't do this, but they set up this kind of girls' training school, and the idea is to actually do what they did before the war, when the British had, you know, the colonial sex industry, which was basically that they would go to, you know, the home for girls, and they would be trained, you know, to be, you know, kind of maids or potential wives. They would take courses. They would learn, you know, about housekeeping. They would learn sewing. They would learn reading and all these things. So when Chinese men in particular, when they're looking for a bride and they couldn't afford one to come from China, the girls from this home would easily fit the bill in terms of, you know, a bride for them. They were quite young, of course. So this is what happened to many of the women, particularly the young women under 18, is that they were rounded up and put into the girls' training home, actually, at Pasir Panjang in Singapore. So most of them would have, you know, eventually left when they became 18 or married out of the institution and assimilated back into society. They had their little sympathy from the colonial government, who simply wanted them rounded up, even though the colonial government knew very well that many of these women, you know, were forced into this situation. They didn't volunteer for it, and still they just simply wanted them rounded up and out of sight. And these women were an embarrassment, and also the military, the British military, was kind of, you know, very much in favor of doing this, because, you know, they believed that these were these women, you know, street walking with no, you know, kind of regular brothel that they could go to. They believed that they were, you know, infecting their own troops with venereal disease. So, yeah, there was a great stigma around this experience, and not much sympathy at all, actually. And that's the way it had continued for a very long time after the war. There was great debate about, you know, this problem in the 40s, and then the 50s. There's no debate at all, because many of these women are no longer working in the sex industry because of age, I suppose, or illness, or they've kind of, you know, basically assimilated or merged back into society, and are very silent about it, you know, because in Korea you have the same situation where they never told their families, they never told their husbands, and you see this in Malaysia too, actually. It's quite a predictable post-war pattern that's not unique to Singapore at all. So, you know, that's about it in terms of, you know, what happens in the 1940s.
Well, and so you talk about in the book, obviously, that then this is not something that's talked about for a while. But of course, once women begin to come forward in Korea and Japan in the 1990s, this topic kind of reemerges. And you look at the sort of narrative that comes out from Singapore's sort of reaction to this, and argue that this, the way that Singaporean leaders react, has an impact for Singaporean women coming forward. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about kind of, we now understand sort of the immediate post-war response from government and sort of their, what they wanted. But what kind of was the narrative in the 1990s around comfort women in general, around comfort women in Singapore and from Singapore? Sort of what was that while it was coming up in South Korea and Japan?
Yes, so this was, yeah, when the international controversy broke, when the handful of Korean comfort women decided to sue the Japanese government in December 1991. So in early 1992, the comfort women issue, which many people had never heard about, of course, there were always, you know, few stories about it or whatever before, but you know, it became an international controversy in December 91 and then into, you know, 1992. So at this time, you know, this controversy and the Korean women coming out encouraged many women in other Asian countries coming forward as well, actually. They had support from various feminist movements, NGOs, even in Malaysia, you had initially the political, you know, kind of parties, UMNO Youth, and you know, had the MCA being quite supportive. Governments really didn't know what to do. Some governments, you know, found it easier to support the women, but you know, many governments really, you know, were, you know, in a situation where, you know, relations with Japan would be affected. In Malaysia, the government effectively shut down the collection of testimony by its own, you know, coalition parties. In other cases, yeah, governments really didn't do that much. It was really up to the NGOs, actually, and the women's movements, you know, to do something. You had journalists, of course, who were keen on breaking the stories. So in Singapore, you had, you know, basically the same thing. You had a government that, you know, really didn't want, you know, this controversy to spill over into Singapore society. You know, you had the Northeast Asian history wars between, say, China and Japan over the past, and these were really divisive. So, you know, the government has had that view for quite some time in Singapore, actually. So, you know, with the comfort women, there wasn't really much intervention by the government. You know, it wasn't really because the Japanese embassy put any pressure on them like they did to the Malaysian, you know, government in Kuala Lumpur. It was simply that civil society was something quite ordered in Singapore and controlled by the government. And at the time, you had a statement by Lee Kuan Yew, who actually sympathized with the Korean women in his statement that he made in February 1992 in Japan. He was not prime minister then. He had finished being prime minister, but he was still very well respected. He was in government. He was in cabinet. So he basically said that, you know, Japan should reckon with the comfort women, but he never actually said that there were Singapore comfort women. He simply said that, you know, it was the Korean women who saved the chastity of many Singapore girls, you know, which implied that maybe, you know, there were no, you know, local comfort women actually. So, you know, this was quite a big statement at the time, covered quite well in Singapore's press. There were journalists trying to, you know, break stories or find stories about local comfort women, but you know, it was obvious that the government didn't have much sympathy for them, and you know, the society itself, you know, at that time had you know, very hypocritical attitudes to women who worked in the sex industry. Even women who had actually ceased working in the sex industry, there was, you know, a great deal of stigma. Attitudes were very Victorian, and basically, you know, even women who were, you know, basically working in the kind of regulated sex industry of Singapore, you know, didn't talk about it at all to their neighbors or whatever, because, you know, there was this fear of being ostracized and, you know, shamed. Very much similar to what happened in the 40s with the local women who actually were known to be working in the Japanese sex industry. So what happened was that, yeah, basically you have this kind of patriarchal oppression of these women continuing in Singapore. And yeah, it's no surprise that the women decided, you know, that they would remain quiet. Actually, you had, you know, I think one government member of parliament who actually even said this. He said that basically it seems to be that the women who were comfort women in Singapore have chosen to remain quiet, and also the government, you know, itself, you know, has chosen not to take up this issue. So through this, the window of opportunity of these women coming forward and basically, you know, writing, you know, that page of forgotten women's history in Singapore's national history never occurred. And it's of lasting regret. Having worked here since the early 90s, I always thought it would happen at some point. And then by 2019, when I started to actually write the book itself, I knew that it would never happen. And, you know, it's still my opinion that it would never happen at all. Even in Malaysia, despite the initial encouragement, even then, the women that did come forward actually used not their real names. They used just names like Madam X or Madam Lim. Only one ever came forward. This was after the government tried to suppress it. She was Rosalind Saw, actually. And that was in 1994, after the government had been, you know, basically telling its coalition, you know, parties and activists in them to not pursue this matter because it might damage relations with Japan. So, yeah, it's not surprising, I suppose, given that in Malaysia you had, you know, that type of, you know, kind of help, you know, initial help anyway, that was shut down, that, you know, in Singapore, nothing happened in terms of no women came forward. And it's been that way ever since.
Mm. But of course, as you mentioned right at the beginning of this interview, there has been some discussion of it in Singapore, if not through women coming forward with their own personal experiences, but representations and memories in popular culture. And you mentioned obviously this 2019 novel, but the book explores sort of other representations of comfort women in Singapore and from Singapore, in Singaporean popular culture, more than just the one book. So I was wondering if you could maybe tell us about some of those representations.
Yes, the representations do kind of reflect, you know, what's going on in society. Initially, when the first representations happen of the comfort women, they're you know, on Chinese TV, they're kind of dramas that depict, you know, Taiwanese women who come to Singapore. So that's the early, you know, 1994, 90s kind of representation. And then gradually we get to see, you know, theater productions, and we get to see some television dramas that, you know, include local women as comfort women. This is after about, you know, this is about, you know, early 21st century. So, yeah, there's a very good play, actually, that sums up the problem of the comfort women. It's about a Malay comfort woman. It's called The Life of Hayati. And it's a story about, you know, a Malay lady, who, young woman actually, who is coerced into the comfort woman system. And it's actually a very interesting play because it's a critique of the society that, you know, allowed these women to, you know, go into the comfort woman system. And then also when, you know, the war had finished, they ostracized them. So it was, you know, a kind of critique of Singapore society after the war too, why women were, you know, oppressed by this patriarchy. You know, you see the protagonist in the play, and she is kind of, you know, struggling with her own, you know, kind of problems as, you know, as a woman who is a young woman going through domestic violence, actually. So there's a kind of parallel between, you know, her role in Singapore society where she's experiencing some kind of domestic violence, and then there's a parallel between the comfort woman in the play who's experiencing, you know, kind of the horror of this type of, you know, kind of patriarchal nightmare. So, yeah, that's, you know, perhaps the strongest critique of it, but it is in popular culture, and local women are represented in popular culture. But yeah, it's something that's not that strong in a way. But yeah, looking at, you know, its representation, it does make you think about, you know, yes, there seems to be an awareness that there were local comfort women, because it's in the popular culture, it's in the plays, you know, it's on TV. But actually, in a way, these plays and theatre productions, they don't happen that often. But the fact that they're there does illustrate that there is some consciousness amongst some part of the population that these women did exist, and they were silenced by the society, I would say, you know, and also, you know, the government of that society, I suppose.
Mm. Well, and your book certainly helps with that as well, understanding who the women were, what happened to them, and then how they've been remembered and silenced since, which sort of brings me, I suppose, to my last question, and probably only a little bit about the book. It has just come out. Obviously, it's something you've been working on for a while. But is there anything that you might have your eye on to work on next that you could give our listeners a sneak preview of?
Oh, with the Singapore Comfort Women, I initially thought that actually it might be better to actually write a book about both Malaysian and Singapore women together. But I decided to just settle on Singapore. But I had still, you know, the material to look at Malaysia. And I've got a, you know, an academic article coming out in the Women's History Review as part of a special issue on the comfort women in many countries in Asia, you know, Vietnam as well. We don't hear anything about the Vietnamese comfort women, as well as Indonesia and the Philippines and other parts of Asia. So, yeah, I contributed something on a comparative study of comfort women in Malaysia with the comfort women of Singapore. You know, I had thought perhaps maybe to move on to Malaysia. But, yeah, after having gone through so many difficulties of getting the book out, just dealing with Singapore, I thought, well, I'll kind of just, you know, just not, you know, do a book, but actually just do a comparative article that deals with Malaysia, because they share a common history, the two countries, actually, the same type of people, and also, you know, their history is history that overlaps in a sense, you know. So Yeah, that's the next thing, actually. I don't know if I'll ever have the, you know, the strength to actually go into the study of Malaysian comfort women in terms of, you know, the way I looked at Singapore society and its, you know, its comfort women. But, you know, that was something that is coming out anyway. So, you know, I'll see, actually, because, yeah, basically I've tended to write about Malaysia and Singapore together. But having gone through the difficulties, the controversial issues, the emotional traumas that this issue presents. I'm not sure if I want to do it again. With actually, this time would be, you know, much more field work, you know, traveling through Malaysia. But I think it's still, you know, an issue that needs, you know, a kind of book length, you know, treatment. The comfort women of Malaysia. I'm just, you know, surprised that one could, you know, actually achieve getting a book out on the comfort women of Singapore, given all the issues that come up in terms of, you know, the methodology, in terms of evidence, in terms of ethics, and in terms of all these things that make such a book on such an issue so difficult to write. But I've had, you know, many, many people help, you know, through linguistically, through, you know, research as well. So I mentioned many of them in the book. I'm very much indebted to them as well, because what has happened is that the comfort women of Singapore it's been proven that they've existed, they did exist, but they've kept their privacy. I think one of the reviewers of the book said this, actually, that this is what it achieves, in a sense. It proves that these women exist for, you know, for history, for prosperity, but also, you know, they've gone to their graves without, you know, going through the, you know, kind of traumas of reliving their past, you know, experiences of the war, and they've kept their privacy. So I'm quite happy that the book has achieved this. And initially I thought, you know, it would be somewhat criticized because, you know, basically, you know, and towards the end I don't, you know, basically have, you know, reproductions of an interview with a Singapore comfort woman. But from the book, you get the sense that these women did exist. There's more than enough evidence, but they've chosen to remain silent.
Well, thank you very much for sharing these insights with us. And as a reminder to our listeners, the book is titled The Comfort Women of Singapore in History and Memory, from the National University of Singapore Press. Kevin, thank you so much for being with us on the podcast.
Thanks, Miranda.